that I like to think that I am a do the right thing kind of guy. And already, some of you are probably thinking, that's not true because I know some wrong things you have done. Please do not stand up and declare those at this time. So already there needs to be some clarification. Doing the right thing or being a right thing kind of person does not mean that we're unable to do the wrong thing or that we always know exactly what the right thing is. I think even people who are do the right thing kind of people are sometimes plagued with moments of confusion. We face moral dilemmas. We have that wrangling of conscience. I think you all know what I'm talking about. It doesn't mean we're infallible. We cannot fail. We cannot fall. We cannot sin. That's just not true. We're not on some ivory tower, some great pedestal. We're not free from past mistakes. Obviously, even if I stood before you and did say, as I did, I'm a right, the doing the right thing kind of guy, it doesn't mean I haven't done wrong things, for most certainly I have. It doesn't mean we're invincible. We're impervious to bad influences, temptation, or even the power of suggestion. Because we're still human, right? And we don't cease to be human just because we become Christians. And it also doesn't mean that all what is right is according to our own subjective interpretations, our own personal expectations. Right is not something I decide, it's something God decides. So someone says, well, what do you mean then? Well, I'm going to spend the rest of the lesson talking about that and the rest of my life perfecting that, and I don't believe I'm the only one. I'm going to just give you all the benefit of the doubt that we all are a do the right thing kind of people there. I will say this, though, that the right thing is not merely something to know, but it is something to do. And one of the things that you'll get out of this lesson here is that knowledge by itself is not enough. Action and follow-through are necessary. Many people know the right thing, but they refuse to do it. Others think that it is beyond them to do it, or they think that it is acceptable to do something less. And I'm talking now about compromise and, you know, compromising your integrity, compromising your values. Or some people just choose to ignore because doing the right thing, admittedly, is painful, it's difficult, and it incurs loss. But at the same time, you can't do the right thing if you don't know the right thing to do. And that's in Paul's prayer in Colossians chapter 1 that Mitchell read for us there, verse 9 and 10 in particular. He says, I pray so that you might be increased with knowledge, and with that knowledge might be able to do what is right, if I could paraphrase, you know, to bear fruit for God and to do the will of the Lord. There's some things there, some very specific objectives that he has in that prayer. And so he prays for knowledge so that they might know what to do. And we should be praying for knowledge too, so that we might know what to do. I'm not saying that God's going to give you something other than the Bible to increase your knowledge of him, but in that Bible and in your life experiences, because of that Bible and because of what you learn and because of fellow Christians, you can certainly come to know God's will better than you did. So the bottom line is that doing the right thing is not something that should be limited to a few honest people. It really should be something that every Christian man and woman does. One thing that immediately may come to mind is how can we do the right thing if we're still striving with sin and doubt and failure? And I think that immediately hits me when I think about this sort of subject here. We've got sin, we've got struggle, we've got striving in our lives. How can we justify or reconcile these things here? I used to wonder how people could struggle with overcoming sin without being called what Paul calls utterly sinful. How can people do that? You see someone who's struggling in some way, and it's easy to judge such people. It's easy to question their sincerity. It's easy to suspect their intentions and to doubt that they are genuine. I think I have done this before with people. I think people have done it with me too. Okay, so I've been on both sides of that. Maybe you have too. For example, imagine a Christian who is battling an old problem, say a drinking problem. He's trying very hard to abstain from that drink and fills his head with godliness rather than that lusting after liquor as he did before and so on. Yet every once in a while he succumbs to that temptation. He succumbs to that old problem. Okay, non-drinkers, of course, it would be easy for us to condemn such a person. Say, you say that you're a Christian and yet look at you. You know, here you've succumbed to that temptation. No Christian, no good Christian would do that, we might say. We might even say it audibly, or we might be doing that in that, you know, that conversation we're having in our head there. And we really never understand how someone could reconcile that sincere effort with that, you know, occasional sinful behavior there. And through maturity and observation and, unfortunately, experience, we realize, though, that things are not always as they seem. What I'm saying here is that we all have our demons. We all have our addictions. We all have our struggles. Some of them might be more visible or known to others. Others might be very private and discreet, but nonetheless, there's a tremendous warfare that is going on between the pride in flesh and the eyes and the soul itself. And that's exactly what Peter gets at here in 1 Peter 2:11. You know, I urge you as aliens and strangers, he's really talking to Christians when he says that, to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Maybe you know what that's about. Maybe some of you here know exactly what I'm talking about, or really what Peter's talking about, that there's a war going on, an unseen struggle that is really difficult to overcome. I would say, and I'm going to be so bold as to say, that virtually every single Christian that I know who has been honest enough to say so has some kind of hidden or perhaps not so hidden war that is going on that they are struggling to overcome. And it's not limited to something sensual or sexual, of course that too, but anything that we crave which is antagonistic to God's will. And that creates that terrible conflict there, right? That tension, that turmoil inside there, that contest between what we know to be right and what we want to do that's wrong. There is always that pressure there that is against us, and that can be very troubling and very distressing. I want to be real clear when I say all this. We're not trying for a moment to excuse bad behavior and say, no, don't worry, it's all right, it's no big deal. Actually, it's not all right, and it is a big deal. But at the same time, we got to recognize that this struggle is part of the process, which is really what I'm getting at here. Okay, it is hard to do what is right without the striving after that and without the failures that may punctuate that journey. Okay, so I'm not giving anyone license here to go out and, you know, fail. It's okay. But what I'm saying is, no doubt, you probably will fail. Okay, you probably will make some mistakes, and you probably will succumb from time to time, and that's part of that journey, sadly. The truth is, all genuine Christians do struggle. At least those who are honest will say so. And we're not any less Christian because we do so. Again, by struggling, I don't mean like you're feeling entitled every now and then to, I don't know what the right phrase would be here, to relieve the tension of, you know, whatever it is that you've been going for so long without. Like, say you have a real bad habit of profanity, cursing and swearing, and you've gone for, say, a month or two without any swearing, and then at some point, you know, you get angry and you just let a whole tirade of you know, curses out there, and you feel like, well, you know, I've been good for a couple months, so I'm due. You know, or something like, I'm entitled to that because I've been a good person. Listen, we're not justifying that. No one should be justifying it in that way, feeling like you owe it to yourself in that way. What we're talking about, though, is that when we fall, we're not doing so deliberately. We didn't deliberately set out to fall, but we recognize that we are weak, we are vulnerable, and yes, not to make excuses, but the reality is we are human. So there's some struggles that we're facing in trying to do the right thing. I think we're all familiar with this passage here in 1 Corinthians 10:13, where it says, "No temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it." There's a couple things that passage doesn't say, as well as some things that it does say. One thing it doesn't say is that God is going to make it so that you cannot sin. That's not what it's saying. Okay, it's saying that God provides, with every temptation that you are faced with, God provides a way of escape for you to get out of that temptation. And whether you take it or not, that is up to you, not up to God. God's responsibility is to provide the way of escape. Your responsibility, my responsibility, is to choose that way of escape rather than to succumb to the temptation that we're faced with. What we do learn there, then, is that every sin can be avoided. We are never forced to choose, or forced to sin, I should say, but we are forced to choose between sin and not sinning. So the way of escape does exist, but as you know, perhaps through your own personal experience, sometimes we are blinded by Satan, by other people and their enticement, by our own greed, or perhaps by our own pride. These are the things that get us, right? These are the things that ensnare us. These are the things that entangle us right here. So just because someone sins, however, doesn't mean that we should call into question their entire faith, all their service, and their personal integrity. That is important to recognize as well. Just because I sin, and by the way, the longer you get to know me, the more likely it will be that you see me do something wrong. Just because over time I can only perform so well, all right? And eventually I'm going to let you down. I've said this many times before. If I haven't let you down yet, just give me time. I'm working on that, okay? So eventually I'm going to let you down. I'm going to sin. I'm going to stumble. You're going to see that, and then you're going to be all aghast like, he's a preacher. How could he possibly do that? Well, preacher or not, Christian or not, I am human. And what people do as human beings is that we do sin. And it should be harder for us to sin as Christians because we know more, we know better, we have the way of escape, we're taught not to do that, etc. But the fact remains that we still sometimes do. And we need to come to terms with that. Struggling with sin is part of a healthy, typical, necessary Christian living. I know that sounds weird to say that, but what I'm talking about is not sinning here, but struggling against sin or struggling with that temptation to sin. In fact, if you're not struggling, likely you're not really trying to do the right thing because it should be a struggle, okay? It'd be like, salmon never going upstream to spawn, right? There's a struggle when you go upstream against the current. If they never did that, well, salmon would just die out really quickly, right? So there's a necessity then for them to struggle in order to survive as a species. And there's a necessity for Christians to struggle, to swim upstream, if you will, in order for us to survive as Christians. So there's a built-in paradox there, a necessity to struggle with the very things that take other people down. We face those same things. They succumb, we don't. But there's still a struggle in making that decision not to succumb. Jesus was asked one time in Luke 13, verse 23 and 24, the question was, Lord, are there just a few that are going to be saved? And it's an interesting response that he gave. He doesn't say yes or no. He says, strive to enter by the narrow way. And that word strive comes from that Greek word that you see on the screen, which we get our word agonize. And so I want you to think what he just said in response. Someone says, are there going to be a few or many to be saved? And Jesus says, regardless of the number, it doesn't really matter. But you agonize, strive to enter through the narrow way. What does that tell you? Well, it tells me that going into the narrow way or going through that narrow way or on that narrow path is a struggle, something I have to agonize over because it's not an easy thing. It's not a cakewalk. It's not something that simple. If you'll join me in 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 12 and 13, what you think about what Peter says, and in light of what we're facing today, this might be more and more appropriate here as we go along. 1 Peter chapter 4, in verse 12, he says, Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation. So literally the context there is persecution, Christian persecution. And yet the principle here does apply to everyday life, that we are being tested with temptation, and we should not be surprised by that. It's really what he just said, isn't it? Don't be surprised when this happens, like some unusual thing were happening to you. People are going to persecute Christians. That's what they do. And you, as a Christian, are going to be persecuted, so to speak, by Satan himself. That is, he's going to constantly try you, test you, want to make you fall. Remember our spring series. I think we talked a little bit about that, right? He wants you to fail. He wants you to not just to fail, he wants to destroy you. So temptation, in light of that, becomes not a sin in itself, but rather a decision time. It's not a sin to be tempted. If it was, well, then Jesus sins just simply by being tempted, as we know that he was. It's not a sin to be tempted. It is a sin, however, to choose that which you're tempted with rather than to take the way of escape that God provides you. It's a sin to turn your back on God and give in to whatever it is that is trying to seduce you. With every temptation, we are forced to choose between that succumbing or resisting. The reason I'm saying it this way is that we can't be blind to what's going on. We can't look at temptation as being some harmless, you know, innocuous thing that really doesn't affect us one way or the other. And then, you know, when we do sin, go, oh, well, I shouldn't have done that, you know, and treat it very lightly or with some kind of cavalier response. We shouldn't be doing that. We should be looking at that like, I just failed the test. God was allowing me to be tested, and I just failed the test. Now what am I going to do? And how am I going to resist that failure or resist failing that test the next time that temptation comes? Because you can be sure that it will. Now, what tempts you might be different than what tempts me. And what tempts you and I might be different than what tempts someone else. And that's not the point. It's not a matter of what we're being tempted with. It's a matter that we're being tempted. So temptation does not have to wear a bikini. It does not have to be the form of juicy gossip. It doesn't have to be money. It doesn't have to be a bottle of liquor or anything else. Actually, temptation is usually in the form of one of these three things. I'm just going to put them all up here so you can look at them here. First of all, self-sufficiency. Relying on yourself and your own resources and your own power and your own knowledge and your own strength rather than relying upon God. There's a huge temptation to do that, and it is a sin to do that. We're talking about not just getting through traffic or something like that, you know, relying on your own driving prowess there. We're actually talking here about, becoming a better person morally, spiritually, and really salvation itself. You're the reason why you're going to be saved. You're the power behind it. You're the driving force. So trusting, as you see on the screen, trusting in yourself more than you trust in God and His Word. Not that you don't trust God at all, not that you don't trust the Word at all, but that you trust in yourself more than those. And there's also the sin of self-protection. I've done whole lessons on this idea. I think it's one of those subtle things that people don't realize how powerful it is. The self-protection is withholding our love, withholding our forgiveness, withholding our hospitality, withholding all those gifts that we're supposed to give to others for fear that we're going to get hurt if we give them, because there's always risk and danger when you do open yourself up. You make yourself vulnerable. So people don't want to get hurt, so what do? They withhold all those good things from others. And that's called self-protection. And it's the opposite of Christianity, the opposite of what we're told to do. There's a great temptation to do that. And then self-exaltation, which is really pride, human pride in all of its forms, and that resistance of God, really choosing to exalt ourselves in place of and instead of God, boasting, advancing ourselves at the expense of others, gratifying our personal cravings at the expense of fellowship with God, any resistance of God's word. Whenever God says, do this, and you say, I would, but, or I'm not going to, okay, and you're offering that resistance, that stiff arming of God, well, that's that pride that's standing in the way, one form or another. The truth is, to all these things, that these are natural, these are common, and these are human sins. Therefore, it is natural, common, and human to grapple with them when trying to rise above them and being transformed into the man or woman of God that we should be. It's natural. I'm not saying it's something that you should take lightly. I'm saying that it's natural. You should expect this. Should be no surprise. No, don't be surprised when some fiery ordeal comes upon you, whether in your own conscience or you know, from persecution from the world. Don't be surprised, because this is natural. You should expect that. It is common to the human experience, and especially, in our case, to Christian living. All right, so I've said a lot of conceptual things here, and we want to get more down to definitions here. When we talk about the right thing, we're not talking about any one specific right thing. We're talking about whatever is right for whatever circumstances we face. We may not always know what that is immediately. We learn that through knowledge of the Scripture, through personal experience, through maturity, through lessons learned from our own mistakes or the successes of other people, or by our own observation of those things. Likely it is something we do know, though, intuitively. I would just want to say on record that intuitively we probably know the right thing to do, even though we resist it, even though we struggle with it. We probably know what's right. But the right thing to do specifically, the specific action, may vary because, first of all, not all sins are dealt with the same way. So in dealing with sin, other people's sin, for example, you know, you're not going to treat it all the same way. Some sins are private, some are discreet, others are bold and public. We don't treat them all the same way. So there's a different response. We're still going to do the right thing, but how we handle that or how it's manifested or how it's expressed might be different. Not all people are the same. We don't treat a new Christian who stumbles in ignorance the same way that we treat a mature Christian who ought to know better, even though they might do the same thing wrong. We treat those people differently. And we're not showing favoritism to one or we're not being difficult with the other. What we're simply recognizing is that they're not in the same place in their lives and not in the same place in their spiritual walk. And so it necessitates a different response there. Or we might have different circumstances. For example, I think about how Jesus dealt with the woman in adultery in John chapter 8. Here's this woman who's dragged before Jesus, and of course the man, it takes two to commit this, the man is gone, and this woman's thrown before him, and he says he was without sin, cast the first stone, everyone flees away, and Jesus comes to her. It's a gentle rebuke. You know, where are those who accused you? Well, they're gone. He says, well, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. Now compare that or contrast that really with how Jesus dealt with Peter when he was saying that he was going to die in Jerusalem and be killed by the Jews specifically, and then in 3 days rise from the dead. And Peter says, may it never be. And Jesus turns on him and says, get behind me, Satan. Why didn't he say that to this woman or something to that effect? Why didn't he give Peter a gentle rebuke like he gave the woman? Well, because Jesus recognized exactly the point that we're making right here, is that the circumstances may require a different response. In both cases, Jesus did the right thing. But how he manifested that right thing, that right action, was different based upon the circumstances. The point here is that the Bible does not list all the different contexts and circumstances and situations that you're going to encounter and then tell you exactly the right thing to do in each one of those. Okay? It's just not going to do that, and it never does do that. And that disappoints some people. Like, I thought it was going to tell me how to handle, my dog or my wife or my mailman or in this particular situation. And it's like, no, it's not there for that. It's to tell you basically the overall big picture of what Jesus is and how you should emulate him. It provides an overall way of life. Specific commandments as well as godly principles. I want to clarify something as I say all this, because someone might be thinking, well, you're just talking about situation ethics here. And that's a secular term or secular phrase that refers to something completely different than what we're talking about. Situation ethics does not recognize a universal authority for what is right. Situation ethics does not recognize a moral authority for what is right. And in situation ethics, it's the circumstance that determines what is right, not what is right, how it is handled in that circumstance, but rather the circumstance itself that determines what is morally right. Okay, that's very different than what we're talking about. For example, God says telling the truth is always the right thing to do. And yet, it doesn't mean that we have to volunteer truthful information for no good reason. Okay. And so there's times when discretion is necessary, not to wear your whole life on your sleeve and so on, okay? So there's discretion. Even though I'm a truth teller, nonetheless, I exercise discernment and discretion in how I convey that truth or when I speak that truth or maybe to who I speak that truth to. Situation ethics says telling lies is perfectly acceptable if that is appropriate for a given situation. So we're talking about two different things here. God says telling the truth is always right. When you're forced to do it, when you're compelled to do it, when it is the right thing to do, as far as what you're called to do. Like even when Jesus was commanded there by the high priest at the very end of his trial, I adjure you to tell us whether or not you are the Son of God. And Jesus did not deny. He told the truth. Now, up until that time, he'd been very discreet about how he manifested his identity, but when he was put on the spot and was declared under oath to tell the truth, he did so, because that's the right thing to do. But the situation ethics person will say, well, no, lying is actually permissible. In fact, it is actually acceptable if indeed that advances your situation. These are really two different things. I hope you see that. We spent all lesson on that other thing, but I don't want to do that. Okay? The righteousness of God, let's go with this here. The righteousness of God is always right. Whatever is godly, whatever is virtuous, whatever is Christ-like, whatever is exercised with godly love, and of course, whatever is truthful. That's always right. Galatians chapter 5, verse 22 and 23, it talks about the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, self-control, etc. All those things that we call collectively the fruit of the Spirit. That is always right to do. And yet there are different fruits to manifest at different times. In fact, Paul says against such things there are no law. There's no limit, no boundary, no expiration date. There's no time when doing those things would be inappropriate, no occasion when they'd be uncalled for, no person to whom we should not show them. There's no law, no boundary against them. Okay? But notice that there's several different kinds of fruit. You're not going to show them all at once, so to speak, and you're going to show them in different varying degrees, perhaps, depending on the person, the situation, etc. In Luke 10, verse 29 through 37, the familiar Good Samaritan parable there, Jesus was asked, well, who's my neighbor? And notice Jesus never listed or itemized or limited who the neighbor was. He basically said, whoever's in need of mercy is your neighbor. It is always right to show mercy regardless how it's shown or how it's demonstrated. We could say it this way, that the situation might change, but the response never will. So the situation as to when and how you show mercy might change, but the response to show mercy never will change. And Romans 13, verse 10, says, love does no wrong, or some versions say, no harm to a neighbor. Well, therefore, it's never wrong to love. It's always the right thing to do. Imitating Christ, his behavior, his virtues, his kindness, his love is never wrong. It's always the right thing to do. So we're told what these right things are, generally speaking, but not the specific application of each and every one of them. But just because we know what is right doesn't mean we're automatically going to do what is right. And I want to make a big point here in this lesson that knowledge is not the way of escape. In other words, knowing what is right is not the way of escape, but rather choosing Christ is the way of escape. Think about that. Choosing Christ, choosing to follow him, choosing what he stands for, his cause, his virtue, his piety, his righteousness. Choosing Christ is always the right thing to do. And that is your way of escape. I will guarantee that every time you are forced to confront a temptation, every time you're faced with some temptation, you're basically faced with two decisions. You can choose to succumb to that temptation and sin against God, or the only other alternative is choose Christ. In choosing Christ, you're not going to sin against God because you've chosen the opposite direction. You've chosen to stay with God. You've chosen to uphold your allegiance, your professed loyalty to Christ. You've chosen to stay with him and walk with him, to walk in the light rather than to go slinking into the darkness there. Okay? So you choose Christ. That is a good way of looking at that. That is the right thing to do. You know, you can look in the Old Testament, you recognize that Israel knew the right thing, but they didn't always do the right thing. In fact, that's a sad commentary there. We see in Judges 21:25 that everyone did in Israel what was right in his own eyes. Well, we're seeing a lot of that today that's passing for, allegedly, Christianity. Everyone just going out and doing what they want to do or doing what they want to however they want to manifest Christianity and then calling it Christianity, and that's just bogus. That's not real. That's not genuine. That's not right. So people are plucking right or righteousness out of thin air, going with that, and then saying, and this is what makes God happy. And I'm coming back, and you should be coming back and saying, are you sure? Where did you get that from? Remember those questions? Where did you get that from, and who told you that? These are great questions to ask when someone starts throwing you that drivel. All right, so in order to do the right thing, you have to have the right reason, the right motive, the right inspiration. For example, in Matthew chapter 5, if you want to turn with me there, it's a familiar verse. You already know what it says. Jesus says, whenever you're persecuted, then you should consider yourself blessed. But there's some qualifiers to that, he says. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Does that sound familiar? Like, more and more, that's what we're facing today and will be facing today. Rejoice and be glad, he says, for your reward is in heaven is great, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Well, there's two qualifiers that he brings up there, and that is, first of all, the sake of righteousness, and secondly, because of me. In other words, it's not for your sake, nor because of your principles, but it's for the sake of righteousness and for the sake of Christ himself that you are enduring this, whatever it is you're facing. There's a lot of people in false religion that are being persecuted for their false religion. Some of them even to the point of martyrdom. And while that seems noble on the surface, the fact is, if it's not for the sake of righteousness and at the same time for the sake of Christ, well, then it's a hopeless cause. They're dying in vain. They're believing in vain. And honestly, they're being persecuted for no good reason other than they chose a religion that is contrary to what other people believe. So think about that in contrast to what Jesus is saying here. Those who don't have the right reason, that might appear noble, as we said, but there's no credit there. That's self-serving, regardless of how good it might seem. Jesus says, your persecution, if it happens, must be for the sake of righteousness, must be for his sake. And it takes faith in Christ to do the right thing. You have to believe that what you're doing is actually in agreement with the invisible God, the God you've never seen yet. By the way, you will, okay? So just qualify that. You and I will see God, but we just haven't seen him yet. So it takes some great faith to believe that. I mentioned in a recent lesson, 2 Peter 1:5, that phrase moral excellence there really is the courage or the moral strength to do what is right simply because it is right. And regardless of the cost, regardless of the loss, regardless of the consequence, regardless of how it affects you, your situation adversely affects your present situation or your position, or whether or not other people are doing that. I mean, you're doing that, as you see, regardless of those things. It's the right thing to do, so you do it. You don't sit back and go, it's the right thing to do, but I wonder what this is going to cost me. Or I wonder who else is doing this thing. Maybe if no one else is doing it, I don't have to either. Or, I'm going to lose some kind of advantage or position if I do this right thing. Maybe even lose my job if I do this right thing. You don't sit there and think about that because you're resolved to do the right thing. And that's what you do. Because you have faith in Christ that that is the right thing. That's exactly the situation the apostles were faced with when they are arrested here in Acts chapter 4. And they were told, they were commanded, by the way, by the powers that be. Think about this. And think how this relates to what we're facing more and more today. They were commanded not to preach Jesus, not to teach in his name. Really, what they were told is commanded not to talk the truth. And this is what they said. Whether it is right in the sight of God to give heed to you rather than to God, you be the judge. We cannot stop speaking about what we have seen and heard. Well, it didn't stop there. They were arrested again. And this is what they said. We must obey God rather than men. Just think about, let that sink in just for a moment. In essence, what they're saying is, we're going to keep on doing the right thing. If that bothers you, really that's your problem, not ours. And that's an attitude that we need to have today. We're going to keep on doing the right thing. And if that bothers some people, that's their problem. That's not ours. Because we are never going to have to apologize, should never apologize for saying what is right. It never gives us permission to be tactless or rude, but rather we're speaking about being solid in our conviction. And it may cost us a great deal. There's no guarantee against that. We're not guaranteed to be protected from harm, loss, ridicule, persecution, discrimination, or abuse just because we chose to do the right thing. Paradoxically, doing the right thing is a risky, dangerous way to live, but it's the only way that God approves of. It's not safe. I know everyone wants to do the safe route, right? We got to do what's safe. Well, if you want that, then you should choose a different religion. Because Christianity is not safe, but it is right. And God takes great pleasure in those specifically who suffer loss for the sake of serving other people, putting them first, deferring to their needs. That's exactly what Jesus did. Those who suffer pain and heartache for the sake of living according to godly love at a sacrifice to themselves. Those who suffer ridicule and persecution for the sake of Christ. Remember what Jesus said. Blessed are those people. They shall inherit the kingdom of heaven. There's a reward for such action. Those who suffer hardships, deprivations, difficulties through that obedience they give to God. What it really says is whatever is important to God is worth more to us than whatever is important to this world. Think about that. Whatever is important to God is worth more to us than what's important to this world. That's a difficult and yet very rewarding way to live. So having said all that, I'd like to say that I'm a do the right thing kind of person. And I believe that many of you are too. And in my lesson here, as I said, I'm going to defer to the benefit of the doubt there and give you all that and say that all of us are that way. This is how we should be. This is what Jesus has taught us to be. We're not always the right thing kind of person the first or second or third try, however. Some of us have learned the hard way. We've made a great deal of mistakes. We've taken the wrong paths, the wrong approaches. Sometimes we've followed our own appetites, our own human desires. Sometimes we've been duped by sinful people. Sometimes, quite frankly, we're just lazy and undisciplined. But overall, we're striving to be more and more like the Master, entrusting ourselves to His care, practicing self-denial, being transformed in the process. So I'm not bragging when I say all that. And you aren't either. We're not claiming any exclusive position because anyone and everyone ought to be a Christian, and therefore anyone and everyone ought to be a do the right thing kind of person. It's not impossible. There's no one here that's incapable of doing that. Some of us make excuses, of course. I've done that. Some of us blame others and circumstances. I've done that. Some of us have chosen sin over righteousness. I've done that. When it comes down to it, Jesus Christ never gives us responsibilities that we cannot do. He knows what we're capable of doing, and He helps us in our inadequacy through His grace. Let me just finalize this lesson by saying this. You know as well as I do that things are getting a little difficult out there. It's getting harder and harder to be a faithful Christian. I don't know where this is all going. Quite frankly, I don't. If you look back 5-10 years ago, I and many others were predicting what's happening right now. We just didn't realize how fast it was going to happen. I mean, it has slammed us like something out of the blue here that we just didn't see happen so fast. But nonetheless, here we are. And time will tell where this is going to take us. I don't know where it's all going to go. But I do know this. Whatever happens out in the world, whatever happens from the world against us, it doesn't change who we are. It doesn't change what we do. It will not, cannot change what we preach. And it doesn't change the right thing. What God has said is right. It doesn't change any of that. So we need to be strong and we need to be courageous. This is not a time for timidity. This is not a time for half-heartedness. This is not a time for practicing, you know, something less than sincere Christianity. But it's going to be difficult. I'm just telling you, it's going to be difficult. So prepare for that. That's our lesson for this evening. If there's anyone here that needs to respond by coming forward, this would be your opportunity in our service tonight to do so as we stand and sing the song that Dick has selected for us there. Yeah.